What's growing wild in Maine's forests and meadows, and is any of it safe to eat? Have you ever walked through the woods and wondered whether any of the wild plants and mushrooms growing there are edible? Chances are some of them can be quite tasty. Others can be used for healing or other purposes, while some can be hazardous to your health. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today we're going to talk about foraging in Maine. There are plenty of natural treasures growing out there, and sometimes they're literally right in your own backyard. Now that spring is here, well, sort of, it's time to look for dandelions, nettles, ramps, and fiddleheads, and maybe even morels. Expert foragers can tell the difference between what's worth keeping and what's a potential danger. We'll talk to some of them today about their favorite foraging finds and what they do with them. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. Human beings have foraged for food forever, whether it's berries, leaves, mushrooms, or fruit. These days, though, it isn't the norm to gather your food from the wild, but it is certainly one popular way to go. Today, we'll hear from some expert foragers about what you can forage for in Maine and how to use it. Joining me in our studio, David Fuller. He's an agriculture and non-timber forests product professional with the University of Maine's Cooperative Extension. John Carver is co-owner of North Spore Mushrooms and an experienced forager. And David Spar, he's a foraging expert, author, and founder of Public Edible Landscape Project in Washington, Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have something growing in your yard that you're wondering about? Have you ever gone out mushroom hunting? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And for those of you online, Maine Public's Rebecca Conley has put together a short video of what kinds of wild plants can be foraged in the spring. Check it out on the Maine Calling website or on our Facebook page. And Dave, I wanted to start with you. Let's see who wants to toss in a definition. David, I need to use last names because we have two Daves on the show today. So David Spar, you teach students about foraging. How do you define it when you talk to them about it?
Foraging basically is simply the gathering of provisions by way of hunting, fishing, or gathering.
So that's actually very broad. It's the gathering part of that.
Well, it's all of those things, actually. If you fish or hunt for the purpose of food, then that's also foraging just as much.
So for you, what does foraging mean? What are you mostly busy getting out there?
Well, I do hunt and fish somewhat, but I hunt for plants and mushrooms. And at this time of year, plants are where it's at because mushrooms don't get busy until the end of June and through November.
So what are some of the very first things that are peaking up right now that people can find?
Well, I happened to see coltsfoot in my yard this morning, just beginning to bloom, and some people gather that for use making cough syrups and things like that. And right now, we're just a little bit out in front of where very much is showing.
Great. Okay. And how about you, John? What do you focus on? How did you get started with foraging?
I probably started with medicinal plants, actually, when I was younger, but my dad did a lot of mushroom foraging, so that kind of got me interested in that. And now I primarily forage mushrooms, some edible plants, and then I also fish and, you know, do sort of a lot of food preservation with forage things, too, like making hard cider, canning, pickling, that sort of thing.
Great. Have you gotten out there yet this year? Is it too muddy?
It's a little bit. It's too early for most things right now. We're still kind of just at the beginning of things when they're going to start showing up.
Is that just this year, or normally would you be out there already by late April?
I think this year is a little bit slow to start, but we're still kind of, you know, end of April, beginning of May is when things start poking up.
Okay. And Dave Fuller, you do a lot of work with fiddleheads, is that right? And that's something, it's a Maine iconic dish, and a lot of people know about it, but don't really know that much about it. Can you tell us about what you do?
Yeah, that's right. Cindy, what I do is I've done an applied research project for about 4 years on the effects of harvesting. That's part of my work with the Maine food system is some of these wild foods. What is the what's the sustainability question? Can you harvest in a sustainable way? So that's that was the focus of my work. And then I do educational programs about identification, harvesting, and proper cooking, safe cooking times.
So do you grow them yourself and on your land?
Yes, I do. Yeah, it goes to show that you can, if you have a good spot, you can actually plant them on your own land and have your own patch. So, yeah.
So let's sort of, they're kind of a mysterious plant, these fiddleheads. I know that most people know it's a kind of fern, and it's that little curled up, coiled part of the fern. But I know that I've heard, you know, it can't be any fern. You can't go around just eating those parts. So how do you identify fiddleheads and what's the safe way to deal with them?
Okay, so the one that we eat primarily in Maine is the ostrich fern, and there's four ways of telling what it is. It's a fairly bright green stem and fiddlehead. It's a smooth stem. It has a deep U-shaped groove on the inside of the stem, and then when it first starts coming up, it has this parchment-like brown paper covering on it. So those are nice four nice ways to tell what that one is.
And those are different. Other ferns don't have those characteristics?
Right. None of them have all four of those things. So you don't have to know all the ferns. You only have to know those characteristics to be able to identify an ostrich fern fiddlehead.
But do they typically grow the same places that all other ferns grow? Or is there a special kind of spot that they grow?
Yes, there's a special spot, and I can't tell you where that is.
Secret.
No, they'll grow primarily along riverbeds. Floodplains in the understory of high overarching hardwoods like silver maples and ash and maples, other maples. So it may be seasonally wet, but not wet all the time. They don't like wet feet all the time. It needs to drain out. So,
okay, since we're on fiddleheads, I have to ask you about the cooking part because I have heard, I know that when I've tried them and I probably didn't cook them long enough, you actually get that little buzzy feeling on your lips that is a little bit worrisome. So if you don't do it right, they can be hazardous. Is that correct?
Well, there's been cases of severe food poisoning. So picture a fiddlehead is overwashed by the river floodwaters. And then when the water recedes, the fiddlehead goes about its job of growing up. And so it is important to cook them thoroughly, which means steamed for 10 minutes and boiling for 12 minutes. Our food science department has done an actual experiment with a thermocouple inside the fiddlehead to show that it doesn't get up to temperature, and E. coli can actually survive times less than that. So you want to cook them thoroughly.
Either boiling or can't just sauté them.
Boiling and steaming. Are the two ways we recommend to either steam or boil, and then you could just finish off a sauté, you know, at the tail end of a recipe.
Okay. So what would happen if someone ate a raw one?
If they ate a raw one, it could be surprising later on, maybe about 3 hours afterwards.
Oh, okay. We won't go there.
Right.
Okay. And did you have something to say about fiddleheads as well, David Spahr?
Yeah, I wanted to point out that either raw or undercooked, they're kind of tannic. And when you cook them more thoroughly, they taste better.
Oh, okay. So do you all eat them?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yes.
I'm a little tired of them, actually.
Then what are your preferences coming into spring now, and what are some of your top favorite finds when you go out there foraging?
Well, you know, we're going to start really at this time of year, rather than trying to forage real hard, I'm trying to get my farming things together. But some of the earliest things I like to look for are Allium canadense, which is so-called wild garlic.
Oh.
The state of Maine seems to think it's hard to find, but I don't know. I think the whole Kennebec waterway and the whole Penobscot waterway and the whole St. George waterway and a lot of other places seem to suggest that maybe it's not as hard to find as they think it is.
Is it very safe to just use exactly as you would any garlic?
Yes, actually, it's more like a small onion, though.
Mm-hmm.
I use it a lot. I like it a lot, and some restaurants like it a lot as well.
And you do that as well. Is that being a professional forager? You supply restaurants and others with what you find?
Yes, I do. Sometimes wild plants, sometimes just plain old weeds. It'd be surprising, you know, some people weed out their gardens and weed out all 100% edible great plants, you know. And you
think, what?
Like wood sorrel, for instance, you know, it looks like little clover leaves. I sell that. Purslane, I sell small quantities of that. And there are others that I eat, but those are the kinds of things. And, yeah, it's still a little early, you know, it really is. So I would be focusing on the wild garlic quite a bit early.
Is there a growing demand from the restaurants and other places to get foraged food?
Oh, absolutely. If you're in certain places where restaurants are very competitive and need to have an edge, so to speak, everybody wants to have very memorable ingredients in the items that they serve. So, yeah, the demand is quite high. And when you go there, you need to know what you have and how to educate chefs about some aspects of whatever it is that you have as well. You can't fake it.
So if there's a growing demand on that, and do you think there are growing numbers of people foraging in Maine?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And social media fuels that quite a bit. And, you know, we have Maine mushrooms and Maine foragers and New England foragers and invasive plant networks and so on and so forth. And I'll point out here that some of the invasive and problem plants that are out there are also good for foraging. So that's kind of gets into the no rules area. You can pick as much of it as you want, and it doesn't make any difference. You couldn't get rid of Japanese knotweed by picking it if you wanted to. You couldn't eradicate. Nobody's worried about running out of dandelions. I sell those right out of my yard, too, dandelion greens.
Which parts of those are eaten?
Well, normally the leaves are best. The blossoms are edible, the root crown is edible, but most people want the greens for salads, mm-hmm. and they're highly nutritious. Most wild foods have more phytonutrients than the plants that you buy in the store. And there's some people who say that dandelion greens have 7 times more nutrition than spinach, and we call spinach a superfood. So wild plants are good in regard to nutrition.
And you mentioned knotweed, the other invasive. How would you prepare that?
Normally, that's actually one of the first edible plants I learned about when I was around 10 years old from another kid. And we used to eat it on the way home, just rip the stems off and chew them on the way home. But actually, normally you pick the stems just as they're growing out of the ground, and they look like large purple asparagus spears. And you cook them that way, and they have somewhat of a rhubarb-like flavor, but you would cook them similar to asparagus.
Right. Okay. I didn't know that you could just chomp on them like that without cooking them.
Oh, yeah. They're good raw, and then there are some positive health implications to eating knotweed as well.
Mm-hmm. John, what about you? What are you, earlier in the year, what do you tend to go out looking for?
I mean, not quite this time of year, but ramps and fiddleheads primarily in early spring. But I do mostly mushroom foraging. And so that's kind of like a mid-summer, sort of early summer and mid-summer. It really heats up and then into the fall. So that's a little bit later in the year. As David mentioned, too, I do a lot of gardening. And some of the weeds you get in your garden are probably some of the best edibles you can find as well. So some others I would add to that are lamb's quarters is one that I really like. It's a really good green you can just, you know, throw into your pot. I have a really hard time growing spinach. Every year it just bolts on me, but lamb's quarters is super reliable. So it's definitely worth it to get to know the weeds that you're pulling out of the garden too.
Can you kind of describe what those look like? Are they fuzzy or?
Lamb's quarters, it has also called like goose foot. It's actually related to spinach. It's the same family. So it's got a very distinctive leaf shape. And then it's also got, I don't know how to describe it, but it's sort of these granules all over the stem and leaves. It's hard to describe without seeing it, but once you get used to it, you'll notice it's a very common weed. So it's probably one that most people that have gardened have been spending a lot of time pulling out of their soil.
Yeah. And they could be eating them.
Yes,
so
totally.
All of the ones that you've mentioned so far, all of you, these are safe. These are not ones that the fiddleheads you have to be careful about. But there's not something where, don't get it confused with something similar because that could be toxic for so far the ones that we've talked about.
With either plants or mushrooms, there are places where you can make mistakes, but we didn't talk about any so far that are difficult. But if people think that mushrooms are so dangerous and plants are not, that's not correct. There are plenty of poisonous plants out there as well, and there are ways to make mistakes. It's a fairly steep learning curve, really. Because you really got to know, a lot about plants and a lot about mushrooms to be able to do this. And you have to keep working on it and working on it and working on it. I'll read the same books over and over again once a year.
Do you have any recommendations for someone who really does want to learn about it and wants to make sure they're using a reputable source?
I recommend the Audubon Guides in New England for getting an overview of more or less everything. It only shows a few mushrooms, but most of the usual suspects in terms of plants and all types of animals, trees, everything. So I think that's a good place to start, and it's a relatively easy read. And then once you start getting to know that information, then you can get more specialized. Knowing your trees, for instance, if you're a mushroom forager, is exceptionally important. So know about trees.
Why is that important?
80 to 90% of all plants, trees, and bushes on Earth form relationships underground with fungi, which help them grow. And many fungi only associate with certain species of, say, trees or bushes. So knowing, for instance, that hemlocks are good and red maple probably isn't is kind of a thing that is good to know. And most people walk around in life and they look at a tree and they call it a tree, and that's as far as it goes. You really have to know your trees well, and that involves knowing them field guide style with, looking at leaves and so on and so forth. But you also need to be able to know what they look like from a distance and what the bark looks like and what the bark looks like at various stages of a tree's life, because it often changes dramatically. So it's not that easy, but bark is good to study in the winter.
Good to know. Okay, we're going to take a quick break right now. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Bar Harbor Savings and Loan, dedicated to providing local, personalized loan and deposit services since 1902.
On the next Fresh Air, my interview with former FBI Director James Comey, which I just recorded. I asked about how he seems to be sounding an alarm about the president. We talked about the accusations Comey used a double standard in making public the Hillary Clinton emails, but not discussing Russian interference in the election. We talked about lots more. Join us.
And join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Each week, Saturday afternoons at 5 on Maine Public Classical, From the Top shares the stories and performances of outstanding young classically trained musicians ages 8 to 18. This October, From the Top will be performing live at Bowdoin College and will be showcasing the best young musicians from throughout Maine. For more information, please visit fromthetop.org/apply. From the Top, great kids, great music.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, we're talking about foraging and what you can find and how you can use it. Joining me today, John Carver. He's the co-owner of North Spore Mushrooms. David Sparr, he's a professional forager and author, and David Fuller, he's with the University of Maine's Cooperative Extension. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Jenna Rozelle. She's a professional forager in Maine and in New Hampshire. Jenna, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
So I just wanted to hear a little bit about how you got into foraging. How did you get started?
As my earliest introduction was as a kid, my mother was always an herbalist, so she sort of presented that viewpoint, assuming you were living in this world with plants that are useful to us. And then, you know, almost completely forgot about it for the majority of my childhood and then came back to it in my early 20s when I started homesteading in down East Maine. And, you know, food was a big part of that, and shooting for self-sufficiency, foraging became sort of elemental.
Okay, and do you have certain favorite plants to forage for, or, and then what do you do with them?
That's almost an unfair question.
Too much like picking your favorite child.
Yeah, it really is. It really, the season dictates it. I'm excited about whatever is coming into season, you know what I mean? It's sort of like an ongoing cycle of excitement. So, yeah, that answer changes from week to week depending on what's coming into harvest season.
Okay, and so you do sell these to restaurants as well. Is that part of what you do?
Yep, that's part of it. Restaurants, breweries, herbalists, meaderies. And I did try doing a CSA-style program for a little bit. I'm no longer doing that, but I hope somebody else does. I think it's a good idea.
Okay, but you're doing this both in Maine and New Hampshire. Is there any difference in what you find or how you find it?
Not from state to state. I wouldn't say that, you know, the plants don't really recognize that state boundary. It more varies from ecosystem to ecosystem.
Okay. And I'm assuming you do eat a lot of this yourself. Is that a big part of your diet?
Yeah, a very big part.
Do you ever just eat something junky from the grocery store?
I'm human, yes.
You're human.
Of course I do. I've had my fill of it the last couple of days, actually, because I was traveling back from Boise, and it's really hard to eat well while you're on the road.
Oh, so now you need to get some nice, healthy greens, huh?
Yeah, maybe if we get a little snow melt, that'll happen for me.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling in, Jenna. Jenna Rozelle is a professional forager. She divides her time between Maine and New Hampshire. And I just wanted to ask you guys about your eating habits. Do you pretty much eat a lot of what you find and forage?
I do. Regarding dried mushrooms, my pantry kind of scares me. I have to admit I don't have quite as much around in my freezer for plants as I would like to have. I ran out of stinging nettles and a bunch of other things that I normally like to have around, but I'll get by.
Okay, we're going to go to a call now. We're talking to David now in Rockland. Hi, David. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Cindy. Hey, everybody else. I'm David in Slovotsky. My company is Great Sea Vegetables.
Ah.
I just would like to remind you that it's April. The weather may not be great, but on any good low tide, you can go and harvest your own seaweed from the beach.
Oh, is that, do people need permission to go harvest seaweed?
If you are going to do it small quantities for your personal use, you don't need a license. If you are going to be doing it commercially, yeah, you can get your license. I think it's still $56 from DMR. Mm-hmm. But if it's for your own personal use, you just go down to a beach and there are many nice and unique veggies that you can collect.
What kinds of seaweed? Are there names for the different kinds that are most prevalent that people could collect?
Yes. I mean, I would like to remind also that you can get a guide from Go Online, Maine Seaweed Council, or Maine Sea Grant. But I can mention one Dolph. it's kind of really now hot in the market. It has a very special taste. You can get the classic Irish moss, for which you extract jelly to make puddings. You can get all the kelps, different kelps that we have here. Some people, they call it nori. That's the Japanese name, and that's the thin paper-like seaweed that they use. We call it laver. We don't have that much, but if you look for it, you can find it. Or even what we call a siletius. That's the best description. You will find it at the high tide. And if you want to use them fresh, just remember that it's a seafood. They will have very short life fresh in your fridge, but you can dry them, you can salt them, you can pickle them. You can really play a lot around them in the kitchen, and it's food. It's just part of the foraging in Maine. And we have a tradition. Maybe people don't remember, but in the colonial days, they were more popular than today.
Okay, well, thank you, David, for sharing that information. That was David calling from Rockland, and seaweed is supposed to be healthy and healing in a lot of ways. Is that right?
Yes, it's true. I just wanted to point out that I got a very nice seaweed lesson for an afternoon from David not all that long ago, and he knows what he's up to, and I learned a lot.
Great, and that raises the point, too, that foraging includes going to the beaches. Are you allowed to get clams or snails or whatever you can find out on the beach? Is that part of foraging?
You're allowed to pick a quart of periwinkles. But also, I'd like to point out that along the high tide line, there are a lot of really very excellent vegetables down there. And on the clam flats, you can get so-called sea beans, sea blight, sea rocket, orach, which is similar to lamb's quarters, and a few other things. And I think some of the very best vegetables you can find are down there along the ocean.
Okay. We have an email from Scott. He says, I pick fiddleheads each spring just for my family and a few elderly neighbors. I don't do it commercially. In the past 5 years, many of the places I used to access are now posted. It's really discouraging to hike into a productive spot, look up, and there's a posted sign without any contact info. I understand people wanting to post their land due to a few bad apples, people making a mess, etc. My family posts their woodlot for safety reasons. Come hunting season, they want to know who's out there and when, so that there aren't too many people in the same area. I simply would like to put out a request to the landowners to make sure their contact information is clearly listed on those posted signs, as it is on our woodlot. I'd like to be able to contact you to ask permission to go pick a couple buckets of fiddleheads. Dave Fuller, is this a big problem with when you can and cannot go on someone's property to pick and forage for things?
Well, it's in my neck of the woods, it's fairly prevalent because it's a commercial operation, so people do harvest. It's important to ask for permission before you harvest from someone's land. So I think it's just basic. Respect for the landowner, but the issue has been that when the trespass has occurred repeatedly, people harvesting at night, and the landowner can't have any of their own fiddleheads, that's when people post the land. So I think if folks ask for permission, then that we might be able to prevent that posting, and everyone can share in the resource.
Is that the case for all other, not just fiddleheads, but anything that someone wants to go find?
Well, it should go for anyone really. If you're going to come onto my land, I really appreciate you asking permission to do that, to hunt or whatever. I'll freely grant it. But also, you have to pick in such a way that there's going to be something left too, which doesn't mean to pick everything.
Yeah, John, you also experienced the end where you're going onto someone's property, but you ask permission first.
Yeah, a lot of times with apples, when I'm harvesting apples in the fall, it's that people may have old trees that they're not super aware of that are on their land, and I'll just go and ask them ahead of time. And that's one of my favorite parts about foraging, is because then it puts you in this situation where you're interacting with this person about this resource they have. And most of the time, people are actually really excited about that. They may not know that what they have is really edible or desirable, and they're really excited to learn that it's something that someone else would care so much to go and ask them about.
So it's actually usually a positive experience for
Yeah,
you.
Yeah, in my experience.
No one said, get off my land so
No,
far.
No, and a lot of times they'll point me in other directions. They'll be like, oh, my neighbor has a ton of apple trees on their property. You should go talk to them. There's some really cool ones over there. Yeah.
So what do you do with the apples?
So this fall, I did can some applesauce, but I mostly was collecting apples for hard cider. For me, I do a lot of foraging just as sort of a almost self-sufficiency piece of it, too. So I try to go out and collect the things that will, I can put up for the winter and can be the majority of my food that I'm subsisting on for those months. So I also do a lot of mackerel fishing, squid fishing, things I can smoke, can preserve, that sort of thing.
Well, you're busy.
Me too. Me too. I do the same thing, mackerel and squid. I fish every summer down in Rockport.
And this is the main way, really. I mean, that's why this sort of foraging fits into the way Mainers have lived all along, correct?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to go to a call now. Nemo in Steuben. Hi, Nemo. What did you want to talk about?
I wanted to read something to you. It's brief. In a Mailer National Forest in eastern Oregon, it was reported that a fungus, Amaryllis ostreae, honey mushroom, extended over 2,200 acres with a mass of 605 tons, thought to be the largest organism in terms of area in the world.
Okay, does anyone know what Nemo's talking about?
I do.
Okay.
He's right. It's true. The largest organism known is a fungal mycelium.
Is it continuous?
It is.
Wow. That's interesting. And is it edible?
It is.
That one, yeah. Yeah, and that's probably much more common than we realize, because the mycelial part of the life cycle exists in the soil and in the trees that you're seeing the mushrooms growing off of, but you don't normally see that. But it can be continuous over acres and acres, and they actually test the DNA and can see that that's all one individual that's, you know, super prevalent in that forest.
Well, someone should make a horror movie about that. Thank you, Nemo. And I wanted to read an email from Earl. He says, as a young boy, we used to eat the roots of a fern, and we thought it tasted like banana, but I don't remember which fern it was. Dave, do you take a stab at anything that tastes like banana?
I'm guessing it's ostrich fern. When you pick it, it smells, to me, vaguely banana-like. What do you think, David?
I haven't noticed it. I have to tell the truth.
That's my best guess. It does smell kind of banana-like.
Okay. Dave, I also wanted to ask you about the wild leeks that you work with. Those are also called ramps, right?
Right. Yeah, it's the same plant. Maine does have a population of wild leeks. Allium trichocum is a Latin name. They're a small plant, about maybe 8 inches tall, looking somewhat like a lily of the valley, which is poisonous, by the way. You can tell wild leeks by just taking a little piece of the leaf and crushing it up, and it smells strongly of like a mix between onion and garlic. So that's a plant that's going to be coming up at any time now out in the back of my house. It's just starting to poke up. It's one of the very first things to come up in the spring.
Are there certain signs for if someone's going out looking that you look specifically in certain kind of places?
Yeah, the growth that it likes would be on maybe hillsides with sugar maple or other kinds of hardwoods. Also, like fiddleheads, these overheads are high overarching. They don't like growing with a lot of competition, mid-story and short trees, especially conifers. They may grow in with fiddleheads, but they tend to grow a little bit upland of fiddleheads, really rich, high humus soils.
Okay. We'll go to a call from Stuart in Pittsburgh. Hi, Stuart. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
Yeah, I just actually had a quick comment about how enriching foraging can be for one's life. David Spahr actually took my wife, Sarah, and I out foraging 5 years ago, and it just really opened our eyes to everything that was out there. And it started with mushrooms, and Dave, when we went out, shared his definition of what foraging is. And I just want to echo how accurate that is, and it really made us look at everything we were doing differently. And so it started with mushrooms.
I think we lost him. Sorry about that. So as far as you do take people out, he mentioned, David.
Yes, I do. I do both foraging and mushroom walks with groups throughout the season. And recently I've been doing that at the Long Branch School in Bodenham, at the Fields Pond Audubon Center up in Holden, Hidden Valley Nature Center, other places as well. And I do some programs in with bed and breakfast places. I do some private walks, and I also do PowerPoint shows and cooking demonstrations.
Okay, wonderful. We're going to take a quick break now, but first a word about tomorrow's show. Join host Keith Shortall for a conversation about genealogy and the surging interest in finding your roots. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make calling possible, as do CEI, celebrating 40 years of building an economy that works for everyone with an event on April 25th, ceimaine.org. Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems, norrisinc.com. And Roosevelt Campobello International Park, inviting you to hear Eleanor's story at Tea with Eleanor, reservations at fdr.net.
On the next Speaking in Maine, we go to the University of Southern Maine in Portland.
To adopt a purpose beyond shareholder value maximization is not only legal and moral, but quite possibly profitable.
Rebecca Henderson is a professor at Harvard Business School. She teaches an MBA class on reimagining capitalism, and she explores its value beyond the bottom line. That's on the next Speaking in Maine, Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Ricardo Muti is widely known as today's leading Verdi conductor, who's worked to honor the composer's original intentions. On the next Chicago Symphony Orchestra broadcast, he'll conduct four of Verdi's stirring choruses, plus works by Mascagni and Puccini. Next time with his SO, I'm Lisa Simeone.
And you can hear that this evening at 8 o'clock on Maine Public Classical.
Welcome back. Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, all about foraging in Maine. Joining me today, David Spar, professional forager, David Fuller with UMaine's Cooperative Extension, and John Carver with North Spore Mushrooms. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566, and we have an email from Paul who asks, why should people forage? What do each of the guests get out of foraging? Anybody want to take a stab at that, John?
Yeah, I think for me, foraging is really nice in that, I mean, there's lots of different ways you can interact with the natural world, but going out and getting to learn the plants and actually harvesting them, preparing them, and ultimately consuming them, it's kind of the most intimate connection you can have with the natural world. And as the previous caller mentioned, the more you get to know the plants, which you have to do when you're foraging, plants and fungi, is that the more it opens your eyes. So when you go out into the natural world, you see a lot more too. You just experience it. It's richer and fuller. And that's what I really get out of it.
What about you, Dave?
It's just very satisfying, especially if you're on your own property and you get out there and you get to know it better, like John said, and you learn a little bit more about why leeks or ramps every year. It's like, wow, I didn't know they came up that soon. And what kind of flies pollinate them to make seeds. And then to have that maybe one brook trout a year, which is what I do with the fiddleheads. Wow, it's a rite of spring. And it's a big Maine tradition that's been going on for a long time.
That's nice. And David, what do you get out of it?
Well, it's something I've done all my life. I've foraged since the mid-1950s. And I've done it, and I've always liked it. You know, from the time I was in first grade, I liked science, too. So everything that was outdoors always interested me. And so it's just part of the puzzle.
Good reasons from all of you. We have an email from Kathleen. We are learning very slowly about the incredible medicinal properties of plants. Many people are in an all-out war against their yard weeds. Japanese knotweed turns out to be a terrific source of resveratrol and other plant components that may be very helpful in treating Lyme disease in a tincture of the roots, reminding us that nature provides what we need. I'm in awe of plants. Thank you for the show. Does anybody know about that healing property as far as either treating Lyme disease or other similar uses of these knotweed or other plants?
The information on that is still emerging, and in terms of actual science and studying these things on people, we still have a long way to go. Resveratrol is something that is highly touted for Lyme disease, but the truth is we need a little more evidence on that.
Mm-hmm.
Resveratrol, I should point out, is also available in other foods, red wine, and, you know, you can buy it in the store. I'd like to point out that just because this particular plant is medicinal is not an excuse for its continued existence.
Okay, and we haven't talked, we've got these mushroom experts here, we haven't talked that much about mushrooms. Are there certain mushrooms that are particularly coveted either for their healing or just because they're really great to eat?
Both. I mean, some of the most valued sort of produce culinary things you can get are mushrooms, such as truffles, are super highly valued. Morels, chanterelles are really well known as, just superb culinary mushrooms. And there also are a lot of medicinal mushrooms that have long histories of traditional use and are getting both more popular in general, and then also more research is coming out on their efficacy. So a lot of medicinal mushrooms, specifically polypores, seem to be beneficial in cancer prevention and treatment. And it's actually they seem to do that by boosting the immune system. And obviously this, again, as David mentioned, is, you know, this research is just starting, but it's a good example of times where the most effective treatment is actually in conjunction. It's a combination of conventional treatment and sort of more alternative treatments. So someone taking chemotherapy and radiation and mushrooms seems to have better survival rates than someone doing either one of those in isolation.
Mm-hmm. As with many alternative
medicines,
yes.
Yes, some mushrooms. I'd like to point out there's not as much of a clear line on mushrooms medicinally as most people think. They find that a lot of mushrooms have medicinal properties. And I'm a cancer survivor, and I've been through chemotherapy, and I've tried different mushrooms. And frankly, I'm not sure if they helped or not, but I did do that.
Uh-huh. But they taste good either way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing is that, to me, people just don't understand how different the different mushrooms taste. And it's like finding a bottle of fine wine in the woods.
And are they hard to find, especially these special kinds like truffles?
Not necessarily, no. Truffles
tips?
Are hard to find if you don't have a dog.
Oh, so they really do sniff them out?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there are truffles in Maine, but most people can't find them.
Is that a secret, too?
The secret is owning the right dog, I think.
How about for chanterelles? Do you look for certain clues in nature?
Chanterelles are actually really common in Maine. It's a pretty good area to find chanterelles. We've got a few different species that you can find, and they come out usually all more or less around midsummer, but they'll come out at slightly different time periods. So you can get, a good, several-week time period where you're picking a variety of different chanterelles.
Okay, we'll go to Claudia, who's calling from Pittsburgh. Hi, Claudia. What's your question?
Hi. I actually got a couple of menu items to toss out after listening for a while. Seaweed, I share the previous caller's enthusiasm for foraging for seaweed. I've actually been known to sit on the rocks and just munch certain species when the water is clean and circulating well, and it feels really fortifying and nutritious. I think we just had a seaweed cook-off up here, didn't we? My sister suggested seaweed lasagna, and I thought that sounded cool. There's another salt marsh plant that I don't know if it is prevalent enough up here to be environmentally sound to pick it. It's called salicornia. It's commonly known as sea vegetable, and they used to sell it at Whole Foods. I've also heard it called glasswort. because it's brittle. It just looks like green tubes, green solid wormy things, and it's salty, and it's good. It grows in salt marshes, but I'm not sure if there's enough of it. There's a lot of it on the Outer Cape. I'm wondering, that's a question, is there enough here? I'm also wondering about mushrooms, because we were told that boletes were all okay to eat, and we found out that boletes are not okay all to eat. The kind that stains blue instead of red if you bruise it is questionable. And I've discovered that if you look in field guides, they're very confusing, because often the same page will say edible choice, and then later on in the description, toxic. So I'm never sure which description of any one thing to believe.
Okay, Claudia, we have a lot of nodding heads and shaking heads here, so I'm going to have Dave.
And how do you make fiddleheads safe?
Oh, okay. Let's start with Dave Fuller on that one. How do you make fiddleheads safe?
Okay, so two publications, Facts on Fiddleheads and Ostrich Fern Fiddleheads, University of Maine, if you search those. But basically cook them well, 10 minutes steamed, 12 minutes boiled.
And wow. Dave, while you're at it, didn't you say there's some celebration of fiddleheads that's coming up?
Why, yes, there is. There's actually two. The first one's coming up first Saturday in May at the University of Maine at Farmington's Emory Arts Center. That's from 10 to 3. And then at the Patton Lumberman's Museum later on, when the fiddleheads are out up there, if you do a search on that, that'll show up. That's around the 19th. It's a Saturday in May also.
How fun.
Yeah.
Thanks. And answers to some of her other questions?
Regarding Salicornia species, what I call sea beans, and glasswort is correct also. The Salicornia species can be difficult to discriminate one from another, but there are places where there's a lot of it. And more often than not, I find Salicornia europaea, which is actually a non-native species.
Okay. And John, did you have a comment for her about one of her questions for Claudia?
Yeah, with the bolete point, we actually get this a lot. We do a lot of farmers markets and events, and a lot of people come and tell us some rule of thumb that they've heard, like if you cook the mushrooms with a penny and it turns a color, that they're all edible. But generally, you don't want to follow any rule of thumb with mushrooms. There's not necessarily these giant groups that are all safe or all poisonous. And you really just need to know the species that you're looking at, and that's really important. We sort of mentioned earlier about field guides, but with mushrooms, the issue is that most of the species that are out there, we actually haven't identified yet, and they won't exist in any book. So field guides are good, but it's more complicated than that. And I'd say the best way to get started is to actually go on walks that either, like we do through Norsepore or what David does, and have someone that has experience foraging show you the ones you can start with that are more or less foolproof and don't really have any lookalikes. And then just, you know, take the time to get familiar with those and sort of start slow. Also, I'll add to that just like with any food, it's good if you've never eaten it before, whether it's mushrooms, plants, anything, just start with a small amount, because you could have a food allergy. That may be a perfectly edible mushroom, but you as an individual may have a reaction to it.
Have you ever run into trouble eating any mushrooms or anything else?
I haven't with mushrooms. I have with plants before, yeah.
So you never know is what you're saying. You have to be very
Yeah, you just,
careful.
Especially if it's something new. You know, like there's certain mushrooms I've eaten a lot, so I generally trust. But if it's a new species that you've never eaten before, you just want to start with a small amount, see how your body tolerates it. There is also an element of, even with plants, there can be regional differences. So that's something I've heard about with milkweed, where supposedly more people have issues with milkweed in the Northeast than they do in other parts of the country. With mushrooms, you can have more of an issue depending on the type of wood the mushroom is growing off of, too. So sometimes you only want to eat certain mushrooms off of certain species of wood that they're growing on.
And we did a mushroom show here on Maine Calling, and one thing that was surprising was they're not... It you might have a problem with them, but it's not like a nibble will just knock you dead. Is that
no?
What
yeah, and you can actually chew on any mushroom, and as long as you spit it out, you're fine. Because actually, in mushroom identification, taste is often a very important part of that. So it's not a lot of people actually when we do these events, they'll tell their children like, "Oh, don't touch the mushrooms." When we're at a farmer's market, which obviously everything we're selling is edible, but even so, if it was a deadly poisonous mushroom, you could touch it and you would be fine. It's you just don't want to consume it unless you're sure that it's edible.
Okay. Very good to know. We'll go to Nicholas now, calling from Unity College. Hi, Nicholas.
Hey.
Hey, what's your question?
So I just have some questions about brewing. I'm brewing all of our beer and mead for me and my fiance's wedding in October, and I was curious if there's any, like, prime main ingredients I should consider using, like spruce tips and pine needles and whatnot.
Anybody have any advice for Nicholas?
I brew beer, and I often use off-the-charts ingredients, and I have used spruce tips, and it's a nice addition. I also use chaga and reishi mushrooms, and reishi, you can't use it to replace hops, but it adds a little bit of bitterness to it. Chaga gives it a sort of a roundness of flavor, and you know, you can throw an amazing number of crazy things in beer and have it come out very nicely. So don't be afraid to experiment if you know what you're doing with making beer.
There you go. Thank you, Nicholas, for your question. And we have an email from Mike, this is a Facebook post. Regarding trees, can someone speak to the varieties of chestnut in Maine and the edibility of the nuts? Do we know, have any knowledge of that? David?
I grow American chestnut, and I also have a couple of Chinese chestnuts, and those species are edible. Horse chestnuts are not. And horse chestnuts are one of the ones that will be a yard tree, and you see it around places with palmate leaves. You know, it looks like leaves that look like hand-shaped. You should not be eating horse chestnuts at all.
Okay, what happens if you do?
They're toxic. Oh. They'll make you sick. American chestnuts and Chinese chestnuts, on the other hand, are completely delicious.
Okay, good to know. And there's a Facebook post from Martin. Don't forget about foraging for ornamentals. My wife and I foraged beautiful pussy willows this past Sunday. Does anyone do that?
Yeah, I grow hybrid ones in my yard, which the flower is quite a bit bigger, the pussy willow part, and they're handsome. You cut them back to about six inches tall in the spring, and then after you've removed the pussy willows, and then you have new shoots about maybe 30 inches long with beautiful spikes of pussy willows. So.
And there are other branches and spruce tips and things like that that people use for decorative purposes. Is that some of the other kind of options that are out there for foraging?
White birch, gray birch tops, people who use those in decorations quite a bit as well, too, for native ones. And then you do have native pussy willows as well, too.
Okay, I just have a final question as far as the sustainability of foraging. Is there any worry that we would run out of something, or is there just an indefinite amount out there of everything that you can forage?
That varies from plant to plant. No rule works. For each plant needs to have its own role.
Okay, thanks. And that's going to be the final words. So thank you all for joining us today. David Fuller, he's with the UMaine Cooperative Extension, John Carver with North Spore Mushrooms, and David Spar with, he's a foraging expert. And I am Cindy Hahn. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.